Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all.
Welcome to Moon Snacks. I'm joined by my co-pilot, my kindred spirit, Ed Hoffman from NASA. My name is Jessica Fox.
It's a chance to talk with really interesting, fascinating, good people.
The leaders in their fields.
They're excited to be going to the moon only with three movies, with snacks, and with a book of their choice.
We learn a lot about current work, leadership, and really what it means to be human and storytelling. We are joined this week by Nellie Wilson, who's the Business Development Manager for AI Services. Ed, I'm so excited to have her on. I think this is going to be a great season. Nellie, can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
My name is Nellie Wilson, and I'm an AI business development manager at Google Cloud. In my role, I get to work with our largest customers on building out their AI and generative AI use cases. Really, what it means is being able to help them go through the discovery process of maybe you're a company that is just starting out on your journey of diving deeper into AI technology. We'll go ahead and help you think about what is the strategy, what is the metrics that you want to evaluate success on? What are your actual end goals to incorporate this technology into your business? And then being able to actually help them step by step in building it, and then being able to have them up and running. Our goal is for them to be able to take this and run with it. We don't want to be there for years helping. We want to make sure you can kind of teach someone to fish versus just continuing to fish for them. So that's kind of the life cycle of how we see it.
My guess is this technology has been moving so fast. It's not like you grew up being like, I'm going to be an AI expert.
I definitely did not grow up ever actually thinking I would be going into technology. I didn't come from a really techie household. Neither of my parents were involved in technology. And then I ended up going on to college, and I went in as a finance major, and I was really interested in business. And then I took my first finance class and I was like, this is definitely not for me. But I happened to be in an intro to information systems class at the same time, and I absolutely loved it. And so I ended up switching my major, ended up adding on a master's, and flash forward a couple years later, ended up at Google and have been here for now over 4 years. When I was starting in college, I knew I wanted to have an impact in the world. I didn't know exactly how that would look or manifest. But I think what I really found with technology, and specifically this intersection of business and technology, was really an opportunity to have a voice in the conversations that are not only affecting our present, but are really shaping our future. And that was incredibly, incredibly important to me. So I'm very grateful. I'm very excited to be at Google doing this. But really, I think just having the education and understanding of how to navigate this technology as it continues to impact every facet of our lives.
You're kind of like an explorer. I feel like I've chosen the wrong profession after hearing you speak about it. And I feel like Nellie's a great person to send to the moon. Although we like hanging out with her, she'll be very needed up there.
Absolutely. You belong on the moon, Nellie.
Well, you know, while we're preparing to send you off.
There's the rocket back there. There you go.
Exactly. I mean, both Ed and I think stories, and especially movies, are so important. It's critical to how you and I think, and also lots that we chat about. So we're going to be kind and give our explorers three movies to take with them on your rocket ship. So Nellie, with that, can we dive into what would your first movie be?
My first movie would be Singing in the Rain.
She's got to talk into the mic. I can't pick it up.
Cut! What's the matter, Dexter?
Selena. Look, Lena. Don't you remember I told you? There's a microphone right there in the bush.
Yeah.
You have to talk into it.
I was talking, wasn't I, Miss Dinsmore?
Yes, my dear, but please remember round tones. Pierre, you shouldn't have come.
Pierre, you shouldn't have come.
Yes, my dear.
I love this film. There's so many reasons why, but one of them is I grew up watching this film. I love old movies, and this one really captured me, I think, from the very beginning. I love a good musical, but also one that I think just visually is so stunning. It's very beautiful. There's so many colors. Obviously, in the movie, the plot line goes along much of the golden age of Hollywood and following this transition from these silent films to then talkies or films with actual voiceover of characters. And I think that it really captures this beautiful transition that's happening in the Hollywood era. And I just love the feeling that I get when I watch that movie. It feels like a simpler time. There's a lot of laughter and love and joy in that movie. And so I have very fond memories. If I had to be sent to the moon and I only had three, this would definitely be one of them. It is a very positive feeling when I watch it.
Because there is that whole song, Make 'em Laugh. I'm trying to picture you watching that on the moonscape with all its beautiful color. And then I'm picturing you trying to dance in partly zero gravity. There is gravity, but less. It is, weirdly, I never thought about it. It's about how technology can evolve things and also be disruptive. And that's so interesting. There is a connection to the work you do.
It really is. Some of the people are very willing to change and are at the forefront of wanting to try new things and embrace this new era of what movies will be. And yet at the same time, some people really struggle with it. And one of the main characters in that movie really struggles because their voice isn't good for this new version of Hollywood. And it's a little bit sad. And yet also, I think it really showcases the world continues moving on. And how are you able to actually adapt to the change that is coming? And I think that when you have to get creative and think outside the box a little bit about how you're actually going to navigate some of these instances, I think one of the big scenes in the movie is when they end up saying, let's take this from a silent film to a talking film, but let's make it a musical. And they're thinking outside the box of what is possible because they've never done this before. They haven't ever thought about what is actually going to happen and what is that going to look like. And so I think it's really fun to have the reminder, this isn't just something new that we're experiencing now. This has been a history throughout all of time, but definitely one that we've seen accelerate more and more as technology increases its rapidness in evolution and it's kind of embraced by our society. It is definitely accelerating a lot of what we're seeing.
It's one of the movies they have on 4K, the big screen. It just sizzles. It really comes to life. You know that it's not real in a way you don't want it to be, but it pulls you in completely. And some people who had been really successful, you recognize before they do that they're going away.
One of the things that's really interesting to me about that as well is when I watch this movie, and I think this is probably more of a, it's a throwback to the earlier days of movies, but they really were a place of hope and a place of excitement and grandeur and beauty and imagination. And I think that movie really captures a lot of those elements. And one of the things I like to think about sometimes also is that movie, for as much as the technology in their day was advancing, there was also this time before cell phones and computers, and they spent a lot of time with people and in person. And a lot of the ways that they come to these discoveries or they come to creative solutions is being around people in person and brainstorming and talking and thinking. And I love that because I still see the relevance of that today. I think that we're very flexible and we're doing this podcast from three places around the world, but I think that it also is still critically important for people to meet in person and to do things in person. And you get a different level of a solution when you're in person versus virtually. And I think that this movie, again, really gives a great reminder of what that looks like when it happens.
Do you consider yourself in the face of challenges an optimistic person?
I definitely would. I found it has served me well. I think that obviously not everything is easy. There will always be challenges, but I think if you can look at a situation and try to pull out the positives, it will always go better than if you only view the negatives. And that has led me down a very positive road in my own life. But I think that it has really shaped, I think, the way that I interact with people and with my teams and with customers and with personal relationships of family and friends. I think that coming with it from there will be a positive solution or there will be a positive outcome, I think helps lead you to that positive outcome, which is not always the easiest thing to do, but I think that it is definitely one worth trying for.
I think Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor were big stars at the start of that, and Debbie Reynolds was kind of new, right? She was 19 or something. Can you imagine your first assignment is to dance? Keep up with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor, and she's brilliant. I mean, she pulled that off with everything she did. In some ways, I think it was a brave movie too, because they did things that I don't think you've seen before. You know, with the water, coming down, and then the Broadway ballet, which goes on. If you as a director, Jessica, had proposed that today, I think your backers would say there's no way that you got to cut that down to 30 seconds. They did it their own way, and I think their exuberation and their confidence kind of also sells that. It's like, okay, this is different, but this is where we're going with this.
And Gene Kelly is someone who has that versatility that he can play comedy, he can play romance, he can be a dancer, he can play serious. He's extraordinary.
Yeah, he's a perfectionist. Supposedly, Donald O'Connor really didn't like him during the movie. O'Connor, who's a great dancer, you know, basically said Gene practiced over and over again. He demanded perfection.
Perfectionism in a leadership role may get the best out of your team, but there's a cost. Is perfectionism important when you're trying to see a result that will stand the test of time, like Singing in the Rain?
You know, it's funny you ask this because as someone growing up, I strive for perfection. That was my absolute end-all be-all. That was what I shot for every single time. And it proved successful in many ways. That was a great goal to strive for. As I've gotten older, and especially as I've come into the workforce, and I think as I've started to see what actually goes forward, what really continues on, and who advances in the types of careers or the level of impact that I would want to emulate, perfection isn't even on the table. It's something that's completely locked away in a box, and we're shooting for excellence. And there is a difference between perfection and excellence. And for myself, when I think about how do I scale the level of impact that I want to have, perfection is incredibly, incredibly hard to do at scale. But excellence is possible. It's not easy, but it's possible. And I think of how as companies grow, as people grow, from either a leadership capacity or from a product capacity or relationship capacity, you're trying to have a level of impact across so many different features and areas. I am definitely not perfect in getting rid of my perfectionism, but I am definitely trying to take that off the table in every situation. One, because I think it makes you happier right off the bat. I think perfection is a very challenging relationship to have. If you are always striving for something, there may be the moment where you get that perfect song, that perfect dance, that perfect project. But it's so fleeting and it's so short-lived, and the amount of sacrifice that has gone into it. When I think about, again, the scalability of wanting to have impact, the scalability of wanting to be able to help others, that doesn't come with perfection. And excellence, I think, is a fantastic goal to still have a very high bar and yet not make yourself and the others around you miserable as you get to that process. And when I think of Gene Kelly in this movie, I'm like, there is a level of perfectionism, and yet there's always, I'm sure, something that he could point out that, oh, I got that step a half a count off, or there was something that I didn't do. And I think when we watch these movies, the goal of perfection or the goal of excellence is, I think, really what drives them to be so great. They make it seem so effortless because they've put in so much work and they've put in so much time. The result is effortless, even though there was a tremendous amount of effort that went into it. So at least for myself, that's kind of the vision of perfection is off the table. Now what can we do? And I think that's an incredibly freeing sentiment.
When I've looked at great teams, they usually have two or three people who they're annoying, but they're driving you towards perfection. And, you know, when I think about Gene Kelly, from what I've read, was we're going to get this thing better and better and better to the point of annoyance. I've heard the other Beatles and their background say that Paul was really annoying, but if not him, we probably would have only done one or two albums. And just he drove us. He demanded us to get back. He was depressed when we weren't coming back. Perhaps, you know, these are the ingredients you need for getting that excellence in the team. You have to have two or three really talented people who are just committed that this is going to be great. And if you have that, it transforms the team.
I was thinking from a filmmaking perspective, you do have perfection is about this idea, I think, that you believe that there's one thing out there that you're trying to achieve. So there's a perfect shape, there's a perfect image, there's a perfect result coming from it, and it's outside of yourself and you're aiming to achieve that. And it's very easy in filmmaking. You're kind of supposed to do that. There should be this perfect movie in your head that you're trying to get out. And most filmmakers would tell you that the process of filmmaking is this long lesson in collaboration and often compromise that takes you kind of askew from this perfect vision that you have because you're working with people. And everyone comes with their own brilliance. So Stella, because Ben filmed it, turned out way more beautiful than I had in my head quite often because of him.
Well, I think the first thing I told you is this is such a beautiful movie.
And it is the kind of thing where if you're left alone to your own devices, I'm like, oh, the actress should have turned a second before and I wanted her to be more in the middle. But actually, ultimately, it's better for her to have landed there and the sun shining in a way I didn't even envision. And so this is idea of this happy accidents or bigger collaboration where you allow yourself to get a little lost. And I think there's a very powerful exercise in improv. It's the last one you learn. So you go through like Second City or Groundlings, like people who are almost to Saturday Night Live level. And you actually throw out what you know. And as a group, you do this very specific exercise about getting lost. It's so terrifying, but ultimately something comes, something that you didn't plan, something that's brilliant, something that uses your intelligence and instincts. That's way better than what you could have planned. So you're completely right. It is this balance of going towards excellence, making sure that, I guess, people, Ed, you're quite right, on your team have that drive, that we're all trying to level up each other and at the same time letting go a little bit of our preconceived ideas of what success looks like.
It's that combination. You can't say, on one hand, we're not going to strive for the best and yet also get the best results. And so how do you have this balance that works with knowing with what we're capable of and what we can do, and yet also pushing us beyond what we think we can do? And there is that magic sauce that happens at some point where you get that blend. And I do think that's where some real magic happens.
Well, I love picturing you watching on a very big screen on the moon, Singing in the Rain. So it's yours. What would be next on your list? What are you taking with you?
So the next one would be Patton, which is definitely a very different movie than Singing in the Rain.
You see it? I want you to remember that no bastard ever won war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country.
I grew up, I love history, and my grandparents love history. And so I watched a lot of military documentaries and old military movies growing up. And I really loved Patton. It always stuck in my head. There's very memorable scenes, but I think the biggest takeaway for me was it's very inspiring movie. They're fighting for a cause that they really believe in. I think that's something to be admired. And I think that Patton, whether it's right or it's wrong, I think he really believed what he was fighting for. And I think that the style in which he did that through leadership and service and tenacity, resiliency, he had a great underlying foundation of faith and inspiration as well. And I think that it's a really interesting combination to see all of that come together. And there's so many different components of that movie that I love. But I think that it's very much a commitment, again, and now that I'm saying it out loud, I'm like, oh, maybe there's a theme here. But I'm like, there's a great commitment to excellence as well that he had and that he believed his soldiers should do. And he had a very shared ideal of expectations and people. And I think that that really helped him and the U.S. to be successful in World War II. So I love that movie. And that would be the second one I would take.
Oh, brilliant movie. Well, it came out, you know, as a kid in 1970, which, of course, was the height of the anti-Vietnam War movement. Some people saw it was a anti-war movie. I think it was really a glorification of a different kind of war, you know, one which mattered. But I think immediately of George C. Scott. I mean, he owned that. He was born for that. And to this day, if I see historic photos of Patton, I'm looking to see how it's connected to George C. Scott. But But that was a selection kind of thing. Supposedly they were thinking of John Wayne.
Wow. I did not know that.
It would have been a totally different movie. It just seemed like that was his role. He just captured it and really told the story of this person.
You said there were so many memorable scenes. So for folks who may have not seen it yet, can you describe a scene that sticks with you?
There's a lot in there. I think one is there's an opening scene and it's very powerful. It's the first scene in the movie and it's General Patton standing in front of a massive American flag. And he does this little rally to the troops before they go and they fight. And it's really interesting because I have not been in the military, but I have tremendous respect for those that do. And it's really interesting what they kind of say is the pump up message. And he's very blunt and yet also, I think, very relatable as to some of the emotions that you're going through and what that would look like when you're getting ready to go off to fight. And I think that he does his job as knowing this is the general, this is who's in charge, and yet also I recognize what you're going through. And I think the relatability and as a leader, that balance of saying, I have a vision, I have a thought process of where we're going, and yet I also recognize what you're feeling and what you're probably going through as well. I think that's a very delicate balance to find. And I think he does a really good job of that. There's another scene, and I find it so interesting because I love dichotomies. And I find it so interesting that he was a very, very religious person. And there's a scene where they're going to fight and they have to get air support for one of the battles that they need to be able to win and beat the Germans. So he says, I need a weather prayer. We've been dealing with this incomparable weather. And he says, I need a prayer. And so the chaplain comes and the chaplain says, well, I don't know how it's going to be received. You know, we're asking for good weather to kill our fellow man. And I was like, that's very valid. And Patton, without missing a beat, turns around and says, because of my intimate relations with the Almighty, if you write a good prayer, we'll have good weather. and they go on to have amazing weather the next day in the middle of this massive snowstorm. They get clear weather. They're able to bring in the air support. And to wrap it all up, I love it because they flash forward and then he says, get me that chaplain. He stands in favor with the Lord and I want him decorated. I can't believe the audacity to think of it and to ask for a written prayer, to then say that it's going to happen and then to actually have it happen. It's incredibly memorable. I did not see that coming in the movie.
What do you take away from Patton's leadership strategies, either positive or negative, that you're like, yeah, that works, or actually now being in the workforce, seeing how teams work, that's probably needs some updating?
One of the biggest things that he does, and as a leader, he has tremendous resiliency. And I think anyone in a position of leadership, that's mandatory in my opinion. But he really exemplifies that through many instances of what he goes through. And I think it's a really great example as well of when training and opportunity converge. He had trained his whole life for this, and there was a tremendous opportunity to maximize those skills. And I think that when you have a couple of those key ingredients, it becomes, not that leadership is ever easy, because I think it's a constant cycle of improvement that you have to keep going and growing and trying to get better. But I think one of the things that really affected him and that sometimes we overlook is the politics of leadership and the bureaucracy and the impact of how that affects it. And in the movie, he was greatly affected by what he said. He had a big mouth sometimes and he would go off script and he got in trouble for that. And I think that on one hand, it's a really great example of you need to be conscious of what you talk about. And yet on the other, it's surprisingly refreshing, the level of honesty. And I think that as a leader, ideally the ones that I have respected the most have not been the ones that were true politicians, that were constantly trying to game the system, that were trying to understand how do I work my way up the ladder for my own self-gain, but truly were in it to be the best leader that they could and the best individual in that role that they could. And I think that Patton really did fulfill that.
The other side, which wouldn't be popular today, but he competed. So he wanted to beat Montgomery. They were on the same side, but he wanted to beat Montgomery. he had this love-hate thing with Rommel, right? The opposition, he wanted to beat him. And supposing it has this in the movie, Rommel had written a book about, you know, the military and what to do and how to think. And Patton said in the movie, "Rommel, you magnificent son of a bitch, I've read your book."
There's a book I remember reading as a teenager called On Heroes and Hero Worship by Thomas Carlyle. And he talks about how a good leader puts you in touch with something transcendent. You know, whether it's a quality or an idea or a vision or, and it sounded like Patton had this wonderful ability to be authentic and human and also represent something that the soldiers could really believe in and feel that they're leaning into.
He would have been a good director.
And you know, Nelly, I'm picturing you on the moon watching this and probably like almost watching it is its own pump up message, and you're going to turn around and there's going to be no troops to lead into battle, but we will get people there.
One of the things that's interesting specifically about Patton, it doesn't always mean that you will be well liked just because you are very good and because you have a vision and because you are competing. You're doing many things. You could be a great leader. And yet there were moments definitely where he was incredibly disliked. And I think that it's a good lesson as well. And reassuring that there are ebbs and flows and staying your course and what you need to do, regardless of what society or people or your leadership or your management think, I think is also incredibly important. If you feel strongly about your values and what you're doing is right, sometimes, and I would argue probably it's inevitable at some point, that the rest of the world will disagree with what you're doing. And I think if you get that, you're probably on the right path to something.
Before I move on, you know, I see you nodding, Ed, and you were in such a high position of leadership at NASA. I'm wondering, did you, along the way of learning the skills that you had in terms of being a leader, did you have those moments where you had to channel a more patent style of leadership? Or did you kind of find your own authentic way of going through it?
And I don't think anyone would quote and see me as a patent. There were times, though, there were a few times I had to let people go. To me, what's important is that you produce that project, that work, that commitment that you're trying. That's the dream for the team and the organization. So if anyone or anything is getting in the way, you have to stand up to that. I never liked working for leaders who were nice to the point where they allowed the mission to suffer. But I tended to rely on a real clear sense of the dream and talking about that and just surrounding myself by a lot of very talented people who were smarter and more capable than I was. Kind of like this podcast. I just show up.
You put together the best parties. Which leads us to the next movie, Nelly, which is such an outlier, and I love it. You've curated a really good selection. Tell us about your next film.
My last film would be The Hangover.
Okay, kids, you're in for a real treat today. These gentlemen have kindly volunteered to demonstrate how a stun gun is used to subdue a suspect.
That's right.
Wait a second. What?
Now, there's two ways to use a stun gun. Up close and personal.
Really
or you can shoot it from a distance. Now, do I have any volunteers who want to come up here and do some shooting, huh? All right, how about you, young lady? Come on up here. All right, let's go, handsome. Come on. Not you, fat Jesus. Slide it on back. You, pretty boy. All right, now it's real simple. All you gotta do is point, aim, and shoot. All right?
I mean, you don't really want to do this.
You can do this. Just focus.
Don't listen to this maniac. Let's think this thing through.
Finish him! Right in the nuts! That was beautiful! Well done. Give her a hand, everybody. All right. Yeah. Good job.
I was trying to be so thoughtful about this list because I was like, if I only get three for the rest of my life, what do I need if I'm out on the moon? And this one really, I think, comes from understanding that you got to have a little fun in life. And this movie, every time I watch it, I absolutely just crack up laughing. It is hysterical, in my opinion. I think it's a really good reminder. You can't take life too seriously. There's always things that are going to happen. There's always good, unexpected, bad. You never know what life may throw at you, but there's got to be a little humor in life. You have to be able to take things as they come. And I think that really, The Hangover is very much a friendship movie. There's a lot that goes around. I mean, and some of them are closer at the beginning than others, but by the end, they are all very tightly bonded through this shared experience. I think it's a really great reminder that the people you go through life with make that experience, and they can make it better, they can make it worse. And it's really important who you surround yourself with, who you take on that journey with you. And this movie just has always made me laugh every single time I've watched it.
Which is so important to do on the moon. And not to dive into your theme too much, the unexpected theme, but this is like the antithesis of perfection, isn't it? Like everything that can go wrong does go wrong. And yet at the end, they're okay. And their friendship is even more authentic and strong. So in a way, it was the perfect journey for them to get where they needed to go emotionally.
It very much is. And I think it's these things you never saw coming. Like you never expected it to start out that way. And when they all get roofied on the first night by one of their own, like it's just an absolute curveball. Nobody saw that coming. And it wasn't intentional. It wasn't out of malintent. He was trying to let everyone have a good time. And this journey that it takes them down, and it is true, it's very much the non-perfect weekend, the absolute opposite, and in many times craziness that then ensues. And yet, to your point, they survive through it, they make it through it, and they're even stronger when they come out on the other end.
From beginning to end, what I love about the movie is they don't waste time. They didn't waste time with the party. You just know something happened. They start with the end, and then they work their way through, and they piece then, and you know, a Bengal tiger connected to Mike Tyson. I mean, it's like, how do you come up with this stuff?
This American Life, Ira Glass did a great episode on when a disaster turns into a fiasco and the definition of what a fiasco is. And I always thought about that when watching this film. There is actual joy in watching a total fiasco unfold. And I'm not sure why. And no, you said something earlier, which is so true, which is that optimism of being like, even if a fiasco happens, if you look for the positives in it, it turns into a really important learning, good experience that will help you later down the line. So is there a particular scene for you that was like close to the fiasco moment where it always makes you laugh? It's like, you're just like, oh my gosh, this is the point of no return for them.
I'm like, honestly, it's the whole movie. But I think the moment that they start to realize what is happening, like that things just didn't get out of like a little wild. It really got full tilt out of control. When they start to wake up from the night after the party and they're starting to go around the apartment, they're like, we lost one of us. And then they're like, there's a tiger here. I think there might even be like a chicken or something. I'm like, and then they find the baby and they're like, what actually happened here? And I'm like, I think just the gradual increase of knowing, okay, wait, we thought this was bad. Wait, it's getting worse. Wait, it's getting worse. Oh my gosh, this is like next level. And then when they go to the valet stand and the cop car rolls up, I'm like, this is just, they're like, what happened? And it's just this, it continues to build layer on layer. And I think that the backtracking and edge to your point of they start with the end and then they tell you what happened. It's this piecemeal of being able to connect all the dots. And I love this quote, and I can't remember it exactly, but Steve Jobs, paraphrasing, said, you can never connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. And with that, you have to have faith that you have to be that it will work out. You're never going to be able to do it in predicting. It will only be in hindsight. And I think that has really been a great guiding principle, not just for movies and how they're told, but also for life. And I think that there's this element of you try to do your best every day. You try to position yourself in a way that's going to allow you to have more opportunities and more success and hopefully get to where you want to be in life. But you don't really know how it's going to work out until you get to probably on the other side to be able to see, okay, I made it to this stage. Now what's the next thing? And then when I can turn around and look back and I got to that point. And it's this ever-evolving nature, but I think understanding and having the hope and yet also the faith, it's going to work out. It's going to be okay. And it may not look the way that I'm expecting it, but somehow all of these things, all of these experiences, all of this work will come together in this magnificent, if not messy, if not hilarious fiasco of a way.
Millie, with the work you do, not to compare it to The Hangover.
We don't know. This is your time to tell us the truth. Go.
But that reverse engineering of being like, okay, here's the evidence that I'm seeing either from talking to a client or something, and I'm going to reverse engineer to figure out what's going on. So do you find you use those detective skills a lot when dealing with clients, when they're talking about what their needs are or how to approach AI, or maybe they have had a negative experience before and haven't done it properly, and you're like, okay, I need to figure. Do you find actually that connecting the dots, reverse engineering, is helpful in what you do?
I've definitely found that to be helpful. The first time out of the gate, it's a little bit harder. And then as you start to go through, you pick up patterns. You see, this was successful, this wasn't. What do we need? What are the questions we need to ask sooner? What are the areas that are going to have a really large impact that perhaps either the customer or us don't expect? You start to go through that. And I think it's not something that always is as a parent. You have to be on the lookout for it. So it takes time. And I think it's really important to invest after you complete a project. I imagine at NASA, this is very popular. At Google, we have a huge culture around postmortems and being able to say after a project was completed, what went well, what didn't go well, what can we improve on next time? And I think if you invest in that at the end of projects, you save yourself so much time and energy and effort and headache when you do additional projects and work. And so I think it's a great philosophy to have, because it really does accelerate not only just for the learning and for your team, but also being able to help more people. We're able to help more customers and to do more things because we've learned from our past. What is it? Humans are the only species that trip over the same rock twice. and nobody's perfect. We know that we've taken perfect off the table, but I do think that it's really important to try to say, how can I accelerate what I'm doing? We've already gone through it once. How can I make it better? And that definitely has had an impact on what I've been able to do and what everyone around me has as well.
I can see the connection between actually these three movies. I was, you know, trying to organize it in my brain. But what you just said is really important. Organizations, teams get better, usually in my experience, after a failure. Because it's after you mess up, if you can, if you have the kind of place that learns, then basically what you do, you figure out, how did I get here? How did we get here? And then you work your way back in terms of, how do we prevent this? Or how do we understand it? So that's the connection between the perfectionism of singing in the rain and the that sense of commitment and vision for a patent and the sheer, man, how did we get here? Man, how did we end up in this room? What are we doing with the tiger here? But it's a learning from the experience. And that's what they do, right? They spend that whole time going back to try to understand it.
So you also get a book and a snack, but an endless amount of that snack because we don't want you to go hungry.
Well, if we ignore nutritional content, it doesn't matter. It's in space. It's a different world.
You'll weigh a lot less, I promise.
That zero gravity thing is really wonderful. So as a kid, I loved those orange, like the gummy orange slices coated in sugar. Those were my absolute favorite. They're like the cheesiest like dollar store item, but I absolutely love them. I had them as I was a kid, and one of my uncles gave them to me, and I have to this day never stopped loving them. So that would probably be what I would take as a snack.
Nellie, can I ask you an intimate question about these orange slices? Because if I'm picturing right, do they have like a little bit of a rind? They're like the half slice?
They aren't the half slice. It's actually, there's no rind. It's like full. I know the ones you're talking about, but these ones are like full gummy. It's like a massive gummy bear kind of.
That sounds amazing. Okay.
Very tasty. Highly recommend. You're only going to have like probably two or three before your mouth starts to go crazy with all the sugar, but they are amazing.
Well, those are yours, completely yours. And what book would you bring with you?
This one was super hard. I love books and I love to read. So I actually think this is a more challenging question than the movies, because at least for the movies, I got three. But one book that I've been reading recently that I think is very appropriate. And so I thought, you know what, I'll take this one because I think it has a lot of validity. It's called From Strength to Strength by Arthur Brooks. What I've really taken away from it, and he's a great writer, and he's done a lot of research around success and people that were very successful in their lives. And what does that actually look like as you start to make this transition from your working world to a retired life and world? And how that's really, really challenging for people that have traditionally been very successful in their working world. And how can you preemptively start to set yourself up for that transition and that success, and knowing that it's not just life is over after you're done working, but that there's a whole nother world, and in many cases, even more fulfilling in many ways than what you originally did in your first career. And I love that thought process because, I don't know, I'm not looking at retirement as something that's happening tomorrow, but
you never know.
But I think that it's really, I love to prepare, and I'm very big on making sure I'm ready for what's coming. But I think more so from a leadership style, even. I started reading it not only just from a self-interest, but also how do you help people that are perhaps a little bit later on and starting to really evaluate what is that going to look like? And I think that the more we know for how to navigate it now, the better we can as we get there later on. And one of the biggest things that he talks about, and that, well, at least that I found the most interesting, was what does the end of a career look like? That time horizon and the skills that are actually, depending on your age, there are certain things you are better at than at other ages, and things that you're better at when you're younger and things that you're better at when you're older. And the time when we think we're actually better when we're younger is much shorter than what we actually typically think of. And so how do you, when you're perhaps going through and saying, okay, well, maybe I manage teams that are in their 20s and 30s, and then now I have a team that's in their 40s or 50s or 60s, and you have this range also, how do I help each person succeed at each of those levels and what they're doing? And I think that's been a really interesting piece to the book that I didn't expect. I've given this book to many people, and I am really excited to see how it starts to change in their own lives.
You're going to the moon, and you're thinking about a book that helps you understand and improve others. You know, I would have bet, I'd be taking a book by Stephen King or something, you know, something that has no social redeeming value at all. And now I feel bad for thinking like that.
My Anne of Green Gables seems a lot less noble. Thanks, Nellie. Nellie, you bring up this idea of strengths at different chapters in life and different ages. And I remember reading a book called Passages by Gail Sheehy. She's a developmental psychologist, and she looked at what happens to the brain over different decades. So if I remember right, like each chapter is a different decade. So she looks at your teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
And I've been through many of them now. So that's, yeah.
But she does say that your brain gets a growth spurt at 70, and you can learn new things and retain information in a way that you wouldn't be able to in your 40s or 50s.
I find that somewhat hard to believe, but
it's worth reading. It's very, very good.
I think it's so interesting, too, because we're obviously, life expectancy has risen over the last century unbelievably fast. And globally, how that's affecting our societies, I think it's really interesting to see how we can view different portions of the population, each with different perhaps ways in which they can contribute, but still very valuable functioning members of society, and how we can maximize the experience and the knowledge and the skills that they have at the phase of life that they're in. And I think right now we do a large disservice by sometimes undervaluing what people as they age can contribute.
Nellie, those are very wonderful choices. And what a strong, actually not just trio, but four movies that you're going to bring with you. I'm glad you're bringing those with you and that we have them on the moon. You've been such a joy, Nellie. Thank you so much for joining us. Ed and I really are so thrilled to have you here. And then, and I'm very glad that the use of AI in businesses and the relationship is in your hands, because you're really thinking about the well-being of folks, and that's so important.
Well, thank you. I'm not the only decision maker, but at least for my piece, I'm very excited and very grateful to be able to help.
Count of the machine.
We're going to have to shuttle you off.
Go for launch.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Roger, go.
Bye, Nelly. Have a good time.
All righty. Feel the ignition. Why am I shaking? You're on the ship.
Good to see you guys.
Have a great trip up to the moon. We'll see you very soon.
Thank you.
Enjoy the orange slices. Save some for us when we get there.
See you guys soon.
Stage one propulsion is nominal. Power and telemetry nominal.
Delightful to have you with us. Thank you for joining us at the Moon Snacks Podcast,
where we shoot people to the moon. And join us next week for our next guest and the next launch.
Moon Snacks is sponsored by Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light, with hosts Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman, and special guest Nellie Wilson. It was produced, edited, and sound designed by me, Ben Please.
Brought to you in partnership with Highlands and Islands Enterprise, the Economic and Community Development Agency for the North and West of Scotland, hie.co.uk.